This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 11th of July 2012. Midori House, in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a panoply of datelines diverse even by our standards. In Madrid, Spanish miners are the latest to take to the streets in protest against austerity measures. In New York, a cunning plan to alleviate Manhattan's housing shortage by making Manhattan's housing even smaller. In Srebrenica, the 17th anniversary of the 1995 massacre. In Farnborough, the latest developments in military aviation.
Well, I was actually surprised by how cool they look. I mean, these things are big. They're much bigger than I thought. I was expecting like a kind of like little tiny micro-like toy plane thing. They're big and they're sophisticated. They can carry big payloads.
And in Beirut, an idea for peace in the Middle East, which probably won't work, but then neither do any of the others. We'll also be discussing superheroes with culture editor Rob Bound, meeting the author of a book about resilience research, and playing a song or two when we get a moment. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead as ever, but first, the latest headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Civil servants gathered outside the Spanish Parliament today to protest new austerity measures unveiled by Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy in a move designed to slash public deficit and avoid a full state bailout. The Conservative leader announced a 3-point hike in the main rate of value-added tax on goods and services to 21%, as well as cuts to unemployment benefits and civil service pay and perks in a speech interrupted by jeers and boos from the opposition. The OECD Secretary-General Angel Gurria says pressures on Italian and Spanish bond markets are very dangerous, and the EU must tackle them immediately by establishing a system that supports countries who are undertaking reforms.
Markets are still charging 7%. Where's the reward? So we don't have a system that supports or rewards virtue, good policies, and that actually protects countries that are doing the right things and that are being attacked by markets because they're seen vulnerable.
Miners clashed with riot police in Madrid at the end of a 44-day protest against a 60% cut in coal subsidies, which they say will force mines to close and put many out of work. Greece's new government has made a positive first impression, but now must push through difficult decisions to get its reform programme back on track, a Finnish minister said today after holding talks with government officials in Athens. In the first visit to Athens by a Eurozone minister since elections last month, Finland's European Affairs and Foreign Trade Minister Alexander Stubb offered a show of support to the new Conservative-led government that has sought to appease exasperated European partners by pledging to carry out long-discussed reforms.
Greece needs to understand that it's not alone in this European crisis. It has friends, and the friends are going through tough decisions as well. My first impressions are very positive. This is a serious government which has a lot of political pressure coming from both the extreme right and the extreme left and trying to do the best in a very difficult situation.
Romania's Prime Minister has assured European leaders that his government was fully committed to democracy and the rule of law after drawing fire for suspending President Traian Băsescu by a vote in Parliament. In the latest clash between the poor Balkan state's two dominant political forces, Premier Victor Ponta's leftist Social Liberal Union wants to remove the conservative Băsescu for good by a referendum the government has called for July the 29th. Syrian opposition sources say Syria's ambassador to Iraq has defected in protest at President Bashar al-Assad's military crackdown. Nawaf al-Faris, who was closely linked to the security establishment, would be the first senior Syrian diplomat to defect. He's from Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, the scene of a ferocious military onslaught by Assad's forces. Diplomats say Britain and France are prepared to counter Russia with their own draft resolution on the UN monitoring mission in Syria after the UN Security Council is briefed by the international envoy Kofi Annan today. The deeply divided 15-member council must decide the future of the mission before July the 20th when its initial 90-day mandate expires. A suicide bomber has killed at least 22 people, mostly cadets, inside a police academy in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Police investigators say the attack bore the hallmarks of Al-Qaeda. The investigators say dozens of people leaving the academy at the end of the day's training sessions were also injured in the attack. Hillary Clinton confronted a painful legacy of the Vietnam War today when she made the first visit to Laos by a US Secretary of State in nearly six decades. The United States dropped more bombs on the Southeast Asian nation than it did on Germany and Japan combined in World War II, in a futile effort to destroy North Vietnamese supply lines to the south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And hundreds of coffee cups were placed in central Istanbul today to commemorate the killing of more than 8,000 people in Srebrenica in 1995. The massacre, often described as Europe's worst atrocity since World War II, involved the slaughter of 8,000 Muslim men and boys captured after Bosnian Serb forces overran the UN-protected enclave in July 1995. The Bosnian artist of the monument, Aida Sahovi, says the aim was to make people remember Srebrenica.
We are building this monument to commemorate the genocide in Srebrenica. Today is July 11th. The genocide in Srebrenica took place beginning on July 11th in 1995. And we have gathered today to build this monument together for one day in Istanbul and Taksim Square to commemorate the victims who have died in Srebrenica.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Nick, and we'll be crossing to Srebrenica later in the programme. It's now coming up for 7 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyoist, seen on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Лондонста Касин, тема он Monocle 24.
Лондонбо, это Monocle 24.
Лондон, бургасы Monocle 24.
Лондонист, сина Monocle 24.
Ди Лондрис, это Monocle 24.
О кики ни наттиру ноа Monocle 24.
Авто это то Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tarvetja.
At least credit Spain's aggrieved miners with a sense of humour. Thousands of them thronged the streets of Madrid today at the end of an 18-day march from the regions in protest against cuts in coal subsidies announced by Spain's beleaguered Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. Rajoy read their banners, "Your future is darker than our coal." Rajoy wants to cut coal subsidies by 60%, part of a €65 billion austerity programme aimed at clearing at least some of Spain's mountainous debt. The miners fear that this will force many of their number to join Spain's already lengthy dole queue. Well, joining me now is Dr. Richard Wellings, Deputy Editorial Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Dr. Wellings, do the miners have a point?
I don't think so. I mean, basically, Spain can no longer afford all these subsidies. It basically ended up with a fake economy based on inflation and all these huge handouts, not just from the European Union, but also from its own government. And it just can't afford to subsidise these special interest groups.
They're not being massively subsidised, though. It's not like the miners are going home from their shift and rolling around in basements full of money. They make an average of €1,200 a month, and their numbers are dropping quite considerably. Is this a Spanish government kind of trying to kill the industry off?
Well, I don't think they've got much alternative. I mean, another problem is that world coal prices are also very low at the moment as a result of the increasing supply of shale gas in America. So that's also a problem. But it really makes a mockery of the Spanish government's ostensible environmental policies. Well, on the one hand, they're subsidizing wind power and solar energy to a huge extent. And on the other hand, they're still subsidizing the coal industry. So there's a definite lack of coherence there.
The image of a miners' strike, if you live in the United Kingdom, brings up some fairly obvious associations of the miners' strike in the 1980s in Britain, which was, rightly or wrongly, was widely perceived as a political pogrom by a conservative government against a long-standing ideological enemy. Is there actually any element of that about this, or is this purely economic reality?
Well, I don't think the Spanish miners really have the capability to hold the country to ransom like the British miners did in the 1970s. So you had the situation in the UK when nearly all our electricity generation was generated with coal-fired power stations. So they really did have the whole country at their mercy. And so really some sort of action was necessary against the unions. But I did think that possibly the Conservative government did go overboard with their actions against the miners, and possibly too many of the coal mines closed. But that was also to do with European environmental policies that meant it was far more expensive to generate electricity from coal.
Well, if there's no echo of Thatcherite, you know, economic rationalism there sort of is an echo of Thatcher, at least in Rajoy's declaration today that he has no choice. Is he right?
I think he is right, and we've already seen the deficit targets actually watered down because Rajoy's appealed to the European Commission and said we just can't make those targets. But the debt in Spain's rising so quickly, it could quite soon, and within 3 or 4 years, end up over 100% of GDP, and that's the official debt, not including all the off-balance sheet liabilities. And at that stage, the markets really will completely lose confidence in Spain. I mean, the bond rates are worrying enough as they are.
I mean, the idea that this might lurch on for another 3 or 4 years is a fairly appalling prospect. At what point in that 3 or 4 years, or even closer to that, does Spain reach? And it's hard to know where this is, because there's a point of no return with the Eurozone crisis every week. But at what point does Spain actually reach a point from which there's no coming back?
Well, it's difficult to put a timescale on it, but we've also got to face up to these very long-term structural problems faced by not just Spain, but other countries in southern Europe. So a rapidly aging population, their peripheral location, increasing competition from East Asia, inflexible labour markets, and also, as we've seen today, a tradition of extremist politics and political unrest. So a combination of these factors means, unfortunately, you know, we have to be pretty pessimistic, and there's no easy solution. Even if they raise the bailouts to hundreds of billions of euros more, I don't think that's going to solve some of these long-term problems.
Does Spain have any cause for optimism at all? Are there things it does well and things that it could build on, or progress it has made in the last couple of years?
It's difficult to tell, and the problem is it became such a fake economy. So we have this huge construction industry that was based on inflation and imported capital from the rest of the Eurozone. And then there were all these new factories that are built based on EU subsidies, the high-speed rail, the new airports that are now loss-making and actually costing Spanish taxpayers huge amounts of money in subsidies. So until you actually unpick all these distortions, it's difficult to see where the growth will come from. But I think if they do enact radical reforms to their labour market, they can actually produce growth, but it's not going to be easy.
Well, among those not easy things that Rajoy has announced, as well as cutting the coal subsidies, is also, as Nick Kelly was saying at the top of the hour, increased 3% sales tax by 3%. He's also cutting unemployment benefit and civil service pay, and bringing forward plans to increase retirement to 68. Are these added up together, do these add up to a comprehensive program for rescuing Spain, or is this basically the minimum he thinks that politically he can get away with?
Well, of course, I think obviously he'd be very wary of treading on too many vested interests in Spain. But nonetheless, it is still quite a brave program. I think, however, the VAT increase is probably a mistake. And to have a very big tax increase at this stage is actually going to depress the economy in the short term, at least. And probably the revenues coming from that will be disappointing as well. So I think that's probably a mistake. But then again, he's desperate for extra revenue, and VAT is quite an easy place to look for that.
Well, I mean, I guess which brings us to the ultimate question that we always end up asking about euro austerity stories, and we do end up doing them fairly regularly. Is this just another exercise in rearrangement of the proverbial deck chairs, or is this the actual beginning of a way out, potentially, for Spain?
Well, I think the main worry is the impact of the bailouts, and whether the current Spanish bank bailout is going to be enough. And the problem with the bailout is, of course, some of the other countries that are on the hook for the bailouts, like I think Italy is responsible for funding something like 18% of the European Stability Mechanism. By bailing out more and more countries, the finances of the other struggling countries are then undermined, and eventually this could spread by a sort of ratchet effect to the stronger Eurozone countries like France and Germany. So I think that's where the real danger lies.
Dr. Richard Wellings of the Institute of Economic Affairs, I have a sinking feeling we'll be coming back to this one. Thank you very much for your time. Coming up next, we will be talking about a competition to give New Yorkers even less room to swing their cats. Stay with us.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too. From five cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
In the culture section, we showcase some of our favourite local heroes, from the record shop owner in Bangkok to the newsstand kiosk owner in Milan and the guy with a book truck in Tokyo. We'll also have a cultural calendar with all the best books, music, films and art for the summer ahead.
In the design section, we head to Marina City, a pair of modernist towers that is home to one of Chicago's more interesting communities. And we pack our swimming trunks and costumes and make for Lugano, where we profile this season's swimwear.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle. It's on newsstands now.
Be careful what you joke about, part umpteen in an apparently limitless series. Anybody who has lived in New York City or knows anybody who lives in New York City will be familiar with a rich lexicon of gallows humour about the extreme cosiness of affordable living spaces. Monthly rents, which elsewhere in the United States would get you a 40-room palace with a helipad and a dolphinarium, will, in New York, barely buy you sufficient room in which to change your mind. Demand for New York living space remains nevertheless frantic. And in response, Mayor Michael Bloomberg is toying with making it even more compact. He's announced a competition for designs for so-called micro-apartments, between 275 and 300 square feet, smaller than current zoning laws permit. They'll be trialled at a city-owned site at Kipps Bay. Well, joining me now is Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, are you tempted at all by this prospect?
I'm more tempted by the idea of a dolphinarium. I think that sounds really quite glamorous, especially in the middle of Manhattan. The competition, it really kind of is speaking to changing times in Manhattan, with very, very high occupancy rate in the city. As you mentioned, extortionate rents for any a size apartment here. But they're saying that, some people are saying that just one in two Manhattan households are one-person households. So the mayor seems to be responding to the need for kind of smaller spaces.
Well, on the subject of New York's, extortionate rent, for those people who haven't actually ever had cause to brush up against it, how bad is it? Paint us a bit of a picture here.
Well, put it this way, this development that they're working on, that, you know, they've announced a competition for, which would have, you know, spaces between 275 and 300 square feet, which is 25 and 28 square meters, say. They're saying the rents for that, those studios, would be about $2,000 a month. And that is, that makes sense to me. Rent in the city is extortionate. On top of that, if you want to rent something in Manhattan, you have to, you know, the real estate market here is different. You don't have an estate agent who represents the home. You have an estate agent who represents the renter. So you have to pay fees on top of your rent once you've found an apartment. It's very, very difficult. difficult to find somewhere here, which is less than $2,000 a month if you want to live alone. It's near impossible. And so I think a lot of people share apartments. So this is an interesting scheme. Alongside every other new development in Manhattan, there will be 20% of it that will be sent towards affordable housing. But $2,000 a month for 25 square meters doesn't seem particularly economical to me.
But is this the kind of thing that the city government should be meddling in? Isn't living in a cupboard just the price you pay for living in Manhattan?
I think that, so they're saying your cupboard can be smaller, I think is what they're saying. zoning laws were only permitting 400 square feet, which is 37 square meter spaces up till now. The big debate in Manhattan with renting small spaces is the safety issue. Obviously, it's such a densely populated city that access to fire escapes, access to light is very important. So what they were finding is that people were dividing up larger apartments into smaller units and creating illegal spaces. So I guess this is a way of the planning department and Bloomberg kind of noticing that this is happening and making sure these spaces, these smaller spaces are legal.
Is there any element as well of, I guess, trying to protect a certain mix of population on Manhattan? I'm wondering if people who might be paid less than others and can work at home, people in creative industries who increasingly can work at home, have been kind of deserting the island for the outer boroughs.
I think so. I mean, there's definitely a kind of pushing out of people towards Brooklyn and Queens and less so the Bronx, but I'm sure that will come soon. Brooklyn itself is very expensive too. I mean, it's interesting looking at this kind of huge popularity of spaces like the one that Bloomberg is encouraging to be developed in New York. There's a few that have sprung up over the last few years in San Francisco, and they are aimed at these kind of creative classes who don't work in their apartments. They don't spend that much time in their apartments. They'll go to their office, or some of these buildings that have been developed already will have communal spaces built into them. And that's something that Bloomberg's talked about, saying it's important to have a good cafe, a good roof terrace, something where people living in the building can escape to. It kind of harks back to those weird kind of socialist architectural models that you see in kind of Russia.
He's not going to be selling them like that though, is he?
No, he's not. He's definitely said the free market will decide, hence the competition.
I mean, but talking of the free market though, I mean, even when there has been obviously a recession in the United States, which is had a huge effect on the property market, have Manhattan rental prices been one of those annoying metrics which have stayed buoyant?
Yeah, Manhattan rental prices have not. I mean, there was a slight slump, so you'd probably get $300, $400, off your rent a few years ago that now has gone up. Over the last year, there have been many reports of building landlords putting their rent back up to possibly what it should be in the market. But, the island of Manhattan is so, there's very, very high demand and quite a restricted level of supply. So, the economics are always going to not be in the favour of the people trying to rent here.
Aisha Spears, Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And in honour, or in recognition, I guess, in tribute. Do you do in honour of before or after? In tribute, in recognition of our previous item. This is the first song for the evening. It's Cat Power with New York, New York. It's Cat Power with New York, New York. It's 24 and a half minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And it's around that time on Midori House where we summon one of Monocle magazine section editors from the floor upstairs and ask them to come down here and explain themselves. It's Wednesday, which means culture, which means I'm joined now by Rob Bound.
Thanks for you described that as an outro to your previous conversation about Manhattan rent, but I'd like that as a sort of entree. I like that. I'd like to be serenaded by a Cat Power song every time I have to rock up and talk on the radio, Andrew. That's nice.
Yeah, we can. I'm sure we can arrange. Just want a Cat Power song.
I kind of want a theme tune.
A theme tune.
Sort of sultry Cat Power song, and every time
I like this idea.
Should we speak to the people behind the glass?
We should. I'm going to ask if I can have Raiders of the Lost Ark or the A-Team or something.
Well, just the talking bit at the beginning of the A-Team. In 1986, Cricket Money was sent to me, all that. I'm not going to... You can't waste valuable radio time. I do know the whole thing.
You do know
heart.
The whole thing,
yeah,
don't
you? Can
you?
Tell, yeah.
But the A-Team were, of course... And this is brilliant. This is seamless radio.
I can see what you're
going to
do
where
here.
I'm going with this. Were kind of caricature superhero types, and I believe you wanted to talk about...
Caricature superhero types. They were rebooted, weren't they, for the big screen last year?
I think we just about got away with that.
I missed that, thank God. Yeah. Well, I was intrigued, actually. I dutifully went off to see The Amazing Spider-Man at my local cinema on Saturday afternoon. And And it was great. It was a great film. And I was sort of probably invited to a press screening of it, which I missed. But that sort of feels like that's the way it should be. It's always nice to obviously go and pay, at least if you're going to pay money for something that looks like it costs lots of money and indeed did cost lots of money. So it was strange to read in various newspaper websites and in various newspapers today, and I printed something off The Guardian earlier, see that The Dark Knight Rises, the new Batman movie, has been shown exclusively to bloggers in the US before any critics, with a capital C, as we'd put, Andrew, have been invited to see it, which is an interesting and weird thing.
Because the usual reason why films especially get cagey about inviting critics is because, frankly, they know the film's crap and they want to delay the dissemination of that news as long as they can. Is that why they've done it in this instance?
Well, I hear not for this thing. This thing seems to have got sort of like a, I don't know how you can put percentage points for bloggers, but everyone's kind of gone absolutely bananas about this new film. It's absolutely amazing. It's brilliant. It's Shakespeare. It's, you know.
It's Shakespeare. I doubt it.
I don't expect anyone's actually said that. People have gone bananas on the, on blogs and on Twitter and on all the rest of it about this movie, which is an interesting thing. So it sort of gets momentum about it, and then it's sort of up to the critics to sort of naysay that sort of original proposition.
Is that not a variation on the tactic I was thinking about, or describing there? Maybe they're thinking that bloggers, you know, if you get the film bloggers, if you get them out of their mother's basements and give them a free ticket and a bucket of popcorn, they might be a little bit less discriminating than.
Well, that's the thing. I think there's maybe two things that we can learn from this. Who knows?
Okay.
One is, yes, I think bloggers are probably more easily satisfied than critics. You know, I mean, maybe if they're kind of come from super geek, superhero worshipping websites, then of course there are going to be things that they noticed that weren't there in the original comic strip or are there that shouldn't be.
There's probably bloggers listening to us right now or furiously typing, you know, worst radio station ever.
Like ever, I think, without any punctuation. There's a comma before and after the like. I think they're more easily flattered to be invited to something first instead of the critics. But I'd be surprised if this is a crappy film. It's a Christopher Nolan, it's a Batman film, it's all the rest of it. But maybe it's not quite as interesting as it seems.
But it's still pursuing the whole tortured genius or
precisely
idea of the superhero, isn't it? Which has been a thing for a while now.
I've seen countless trailers for this, and they're obviously all over the web and spoilers and all this kind of thing. And having seen the trailer for Batman before I saw Spider-Man on Saturday, I'm just so glad I saw the latter, because the former, or at least the trailer for it, really looks like, it looks like King Lear's kind of more tragic bits, except the guy's covered in black rubber and he's got ears. You know, that's. I promise you that was the trailer for Batman and nothing else. I promise you I didn't accidentally stumble down some basement steps.
Yeah, it wasn't just another Friday night round at yours. Yeah.
Exactly. It probably cost a lot more than £12.50 at the screen on the green as well. It is this sort of idea of like where does the sort of navel gazing superhero movie go next? And we'll see, possibly with Batman.
Well, I'm kind of hoping it goes full circle, because I liked my superheroes when they were just kicking ass and taking names.
Precisely.
I don't really see that existential contemplation is their role.
Well, this is the thing, because I always get kind of a bit pissed off about this when you go to the cinema and you see this thing and you're kind of rolling your eyes and then you think, well, I suppose in the original comic strips they were these kind of tortured men and they've got their superhero power because they've kind of some sort of awful accident has befallen them and now they feel that they should sort of serve the public and serve Gotham and or whatever it is.
You never got a lot of that with the Incredible Hulk, though, did you?
I just loved him. He was just absolutely apeshit. I love that. That's always kind of like, I always like someone that you shouldn't make them angry.
And Rob Bound, our culture editor, you are just such a creature. One of very few editors, ladies and gentlemen, who does actually wear a cape to work. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be right back.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afton into Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll talk about how Srebrenica has evolved from a war memorial to a pilgrimage site and check in with our business editor who's been at the Farnborough Air Show. But before all that and more, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Civil servants gathered outside the Spanish Parliament today to protest new austerity measures unveiled by Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy in a move designed to slash public deficit and avoid a full state bailout. Miners clashed with riot police in Madrid at the end of a 44-day protest against a 60% cut in coal subsidies, which they say will force mines to close and put many out of work. Greece's new government has made a positive first impression, but now must push through difficult decisions to get its reform programme back on track, according to a Finnish minister, after holding talks with government officials in Athens. Romania's prime minister has assured European leaders that his government was fully committed to democracy and the rule of law, after drawing fire for suspending President Traian Băsescu by a vote in parliament. Syrian opposition sources say Syria's ambassador to Iraq has defected in protest at President Bashar al-Assad's military crackdown. Meanwhile, Syrian activists reported a new bombardment of rebel areas of Homs today, as well as fighting in many other parts of the country. A suicide bomber has killed at least 22 people, mostly cadets, inside a police academy in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Police investigators say the attack bore the hallmarks of al-Qaeda. Hillary Clinton confronted a painful legacy of the Vietnam War today when she made the first visit to Laos by a US Secretary of State in nearly six decades. In another indication of thawing of relations between the United States and Burma, the Asian nation has welcomed its first US ambassador in decades. And hundreds of coffee cups were placed in central Istanbul today to commemorate the killing of more than 8,000 people in Srebrenica in 1995. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. 17 years ago this week, 8,000 people were murdered in a small European town. The massacre of Bosniak men and boys by Bosnian Serb army soldiers in and around Srebrenica was the worst atrocity of its kind seen on the continent since World War II and is a cause of continuing anguish, most obviously for the families and friends of the victims, but also for Europe and the West, for whom Srebrenica represented the climax of their failure to cope with the first major crisis of the post-Cold War era. The image of UN peacekeepers sitting on their rifles while General Ratko Mladic's thugs herded hundreds of civilians to their deaths remains a stark illustration of the gulf between diplomatic rhetoric and on-the-ground reality. In the years since the massacre, Srebrenica has gradually become a site of annual pilgrimage. Journalist and author Tim Judah is there now. Good evening, Tim.
Hello, Andrew.
What's been happening today in Srebrenica?
Well, it's been another of those extraordinary commemorative days. Today, there were 520 people buried, or the remains of 520 people buried. Up until today, in the last 10 years or so, there have been 5,137 buried. So we've now gone up from 5,137 plus 520. But what's extraordinary is that only about 10 years ago, there was virtually no one here. There was no one who came for the commemoration. And it was a relatively small group of activists who began the commemoration. Since then, the memorial site has begun, was implemented, and this large graveyard has been instituted. And as I say, those are the figures of the amount of people buried until today. And so every year, the numbers coming, both to bury the dead, but also to come here as a commemoration, appear to go up. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were 40,000 here today. Some people say 30,000, but it could even be 50,000. It's very hard to know.
Has it become the single focal point of Bosnia's remembrance of its war?
It hasn't quite become the only point of remembrance. But what was absolutely fascinating today was that given that these people are obviously all the people who were killed, all Bosnian Muslims, and that today part of the commemoration and part of the commemoration every year is a Muslim religious ceremony, what was curious today, it sounds curious, but it's not, so bear with me, was that the one of the addresses was given by a rabbi from New York, and you think, well, that's kind of, what's he doing here? But actually, I think it's actually very interesting, and it tells us a lot about the way Srebrenica is changing for Bosnia, what it means. And what the rabbi said was that he was a Holocaust survivor and that a lot of his family had died in Auschwitz. And he then, you know, went on to make his speech. But actually what's happening, and that's why I think that this speech by the rabbi was so interesting, why that the fact that he was there was so interesting, was that I think that that as Auschwitz has become a kind of shortcut, it's become a sort of symbol for the Holocaust as a whole, I think that Srebrenica is becoming that symbol for the Bosnian Muslim people, for Bosniaks as a whole, which is not the same as obviously Bosnians as a whole, which include Croats and Serbs. And indeed, a Srebrenica massacre survivor, a political activist here whom I know, has actually said, yes, Srebrenica is becoming a cornerstone of our identity. And actually, I want to sort of take this argument further. I think, you know, many people today think it's very odd or it's ridiculous or that, for example, when the Israeli Prime Minister talks about Iran, he also has in the back of his mind or even mentions Auschwitz. But I think that what Auschwitz did and the way that Israelis think strategically, having been shaped a little by Auschwitz, not a little, a great way, in a very big way by Auschwitz and the Holocaust, is precisely what's happening here. And that the way Bosniaks, Bosnian Muslims, are thinking about their future and will be thinking about their future in 50 years' time will be through the lens of Srebrenica.
This is the second Srebrenica commemoration since, of course, Ratko Mladic was arrested and sent to the Hague to stand trial. Has the idea that he's potentially facing some sort of accounting for what he did in Srebrenica made any difference to the tone of the commemoration?
No, I don't think so, because they don't try to be particularly political. I mean, to a certain extent, it is quite politically correct. And don't forget that, after all, Srebrenica was taken by the Bosnian Serbs, and it is deep inside the Republika Srpska, which is the Bosnian Serb part of Bosnia. So there is talk of reconciliation, there is talk of justice, etc. But they're not sort of overtly political. I mean, last year, actually, I saw signs and sort of there were big kind of posters like banners referring to Mladic, but I didn't actually see any of that this year.
I mean, as you say, Srebrenica is inside the Serbian entity in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Just wondering, what's your sense of how Bosnian Serbs regard Srebrenica now and how they feel about it? I mean, Boris Tadic, the president of Serbia proper, famously attended the commemoration in 2010. But is there acceptance within Republika Srpska about what happened at Srebrenica?
No, there really isn't, actually. And I think that a lot of people think that there may have been crimes committed, but whatever, it was exaggerated, and certainly it wasn't genocide. And this genocide word is very important. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which is where Mladic has been tried, has already found in previous cases genocide as defined by the International Genocide Convention is exactly what happened here. The new president of Serbia, Tomislav Nikolic, began his presidency about 2 weeks ago by saying that he did not think that genocide had been committed here, and that maybe there had been some crimes for sure, but no, genocide was not right. And to probably a lot of Serbs would agree with him. What was interesting, though, and the fact that has been noticed, was that the rabbi who made the speech today to the thousands who were absolutely broiling while he was making his speech, said, "I bring you a message from President Clinton." And in the message, he said very clearly, he said, not President Clinton, of course, I'm sorry, I'm mistaking, President Clinton was president when Srebrenica fell, of course, President Obama, he said, President Obama has said very clearly that no one should doubt that what happened in Srebrenica constituted a genocide. And I think that everyone understood that that was a clear rebuke to Serbia's new president, Tomislav Nikolic.
Tim Judah in Srebrenica, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. The observation that the pace of life has accelerated dramatically in the last decade or so is not an original one, but we are a bit strapped for guidance on how we might navigate this maddeningly fluid new world. Andrew Zolli has some ideas on that front. He's the author of a new book called Resilience, and he joins me now. Andrew, good evening.
Good evening. It's great to be with you.
Your book's about responses, both at an individual and communal and corporate level, to disruptions and upheavals. Are there more of these than there used to be, or does the fact that there's more sources of information just mean that we know more about them when they happen?
It's a great question. The best evidence we have is that the pace of disruptions are increasing, and their scope and scale are increasing as well, and that's really a byproduct of our contemporary model of globalization, which ties together systems, ecological, social, economic, and other systems together in such a way that when a disruption happens somewhere, it can have cascading effects in completely other places and in completely other domains. So for example, 2011 was the most expensive year for natural disasters in history. And a big part of that is because those disasters hit other systems, economic systems, social systems, all of these others. So the pace is increasing and the connectivity between them is increasing.
Your book discusses ideas in the field of something called resilience research. Briefly, how do you explain what resilience research is?
For 40 years, the dominant paradigm around risk management of all different sorts has been focused on ideas like sustainability and risk mitigation, basically steering us around big structural risks that we face. But there's an increasing, I think, appreciation among corporate leaders, governmental leaders, social innovators and entrepreneurs and others that we are in a period of such intrinsic volatility that we have to build systems that can go through the storms, not necessarily go around them, because we don't know when the next one is going to come at us.
Well, to pursue that metaphor further, you say in your introduction that if we can't control the volatile tides of change, we can learn to build better boats. What's a good real-world example of that?
Well, you know, there are many different examples in different categories. We just, my organization just convened a global gathering in Reykjavik, Iceland, actually, looking at how Iceland, which is a tiny country of 300,000 people on a rock in the North Atlantic, managed to weather the enormous disruption that happened around the global financial crisis. What you see when you look at that response structurally, they criminally indicted their former prime minister, rewrote their constitution, voted twice not to bail out their banks, very controversially. They decided, really importantly, to make investments in a much more diversified portfolio of activities, so that diversity matters a lot. They have a clean tech energy economy. They have a thriving cultural and music scene in Iceland, and these other forms of value creation are really critical. So the pattern language of resilience involves things like diversification, modularity, getting the right information at the right time. Many of our systems, unfortunately, are guided principally by looking in the rearview mirror. You know, we don't get a lot of forward information. We only get information about what happened in the past. So building systems that give us better optics into the future and that have fire breaks in them so that a problem somewhere doesn't become a problem everywhere are the kinds of things you do when you want to build resilience.
Andrew Zolli, author of Resilience, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. The Farnborough Air Show gets properly off the ground this weekend, but Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, is already there at the area of the show reserved for aviation trade insiders. He spoke to me over the occasional sound of revving jets earlier today. I asked him what had caught his eye.
Well, lots and lots of jets, lots and lots of helicopters, and great big missiles, obviously. I haven't been to an aerospace show before. I haven't been to a defence show, so it's certainly very different to the kind of pace that we have at the menswear shows, which I think is where I reported to you from last. But no, I mean, very, very interesting. Flambe is obviously a huge international event. 14,000 exhibitors, I think, this time round. It's slightly down on what it's been in the past, kind of, I think, 10% down, we're hearing, or something like that. The latest figures, the final figures aren't in, but it's vast, and certainly the place that people come to kind of showcase their latest tech.
Are they more or less welcoming of press than the people at fashion shows?
A very different relationship, I'd say. I mean, everything is incredibly high security here. It's a very highly structured. You can actually just hear a jet taking off in the background right now. You have to try and bear with me, but yeah, I mean, certainly to get access to the latest, to the kind of the big products that have been launched on the market, then you need to be from the right magazine, you need to be from the right press outlet, and they let you in. But there's lots of scanning machines and flight security around their latest designs. So yeah, I mean, slightly different to the fashion press, certainly.
And what kind of, well, I guess, what kind of trends in aviation are people sounding optimistic about?
Well, I mean, the positives, I interviewed the CEO of Farnborough earlier today, and the positives for him, certainly, were that Farnborough is now a truly international event. It's, I think, 55% our visitors attendees and shows from outside the UK. I think they made a big deal out of the fact that they've printed 72 flags this year. So it's for the very few UK-based events that can really claim to be that. Obviously, kind of in the overall industry, although defence spending is certainly down in lots of Western countries, the other three quarters of the world, defence spending is in rather rude health. And also the security as a sector, as opposed to defence, is now looking very interesting. So that's about kind of investing in kind of sustainable technology to secure. I mean, a huge thing with cybersecurity, for example. So that's something that's growing a lot as defence spending goes down.
Is there much talk, or has there been much talk about this gathering idea that the future of military aviation, in particular, is going to be pilotless, which would, of course, necessitate an absolute revolution in military aviation?
Yeah, no, absolutely. UAVs were a huge thing this year. Every big contractor, BAE Systems, all of them are muscling in on this, and it's a huge investment area. Increasingly sophisticated systems, UAVs that can, decision-making UAVs that don't need to be piloted, which is kind of a terrifying thought. And also a big growth area was surveillance. It's not necessarily the kind of model that we've seen from DoD in America, the kind of militarized Reaper drones, but actually a lot of surveillance drones. And this was a big talking point, is the importance of surveillance, the importance of knowledge and power, as potentially we're moving towards a more defensive than offensive stage in military truth, although that's obviously not the universal truth at the moment. But people were talking more about how you kind of gather information, how you process information, how that secures, how that kind of builds national security, rather than investing in really big guns.
You spoke there about the idea of the decision-making drone, which, as you correctly suggested, does sound like the stuff of Orwellian nightmare. What kind of decision does that actually mean? What will these UAVs be able to do?
Well, I haven't gone into a huge amount of detail on the actual technical side, but from what I gather, it's to have very kind of sophisticated algorithms that allow it to make a decision-making process within that drone. So to put a number of kind of incidents together and be able to make a decision on whether it makes a strike on that location in that moment.
The trouble is,
the technology does exist out there already. And it should be said that there are drones that decision making, but that is becoming more and more sophisticated.
They don't look as cool as fighter planes, though, do they?
Well, I was actually surprised by how cool they look.
Really?
I mean, these things are big. They're much bigger than I thought. I was expecting like a kind of like little, tiny, micro-like toy plane thing. They're big and they're sophisticated. They can carry big payloads, whether that's a kind of radar scanning machine or missiles. They're pretty impressive. I mean, that's generally the thing as well, is that the kit here is extraordinary. And to kind of see it all in one place as well, and to see really very different kind of national visions of what military kit should look like. Military and civilian, as we said. I mean, this is also a huge concern, civilian aerospace fair as well in general. Military is defense is just a small aspect of what they do. But yeah, it is fascinating to see the kind of everything. It's the international aerospace industry turned inside out, and seeing them all kind of jostling cheek by jowl. It's an interesting one.
That was Jonathan Openshaw at the Farnborough Air Show. It's 1851 in London. You're listening to Midori House. And finally tonight, given that we've got, 8.5 minutes left to the top of the hour, we're going to bring peace to the Middle East. How hard can that be? Lebanon-based games developer Gamecooks have an idea on this front. Their latest iPhone and iPad game, Run for Peace, invites players to navigate a character called Salim across the perennially fractious region, bringing peace to the area, country by country. Starting in Saudi Arabia and finishing in Algeria, Salim must be guided around bombs, oil spills, and the occasional flying shisha pipe. At the very least, it's probably no less likely to succeed than many more earnest plans for calming down the Middle East, and if nothing else, 5% of proceeds from downloads are being donated to UNESCO. Well, earlier, I spoke to Lebanon Nader, the co-founder of Gamecooks. I started by asking where the main market for his game is.
Actually, all our games are really targeting the Arabic audience, whether they are in the Middle East or anywhere in the world. Our primary target market is the Middle East, actually. So that's Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Dubai, Egypt, and the rest of those countries. And the secondary target audience for us is Arabs living abroad, mainly in the UK, in France, in Germany, moving on to the US, Canada, Latin America. So, anywhere there's Arabs, we are targeting. And then thirdly, and as well important as the others, is the rest of the world. But as you see, all our games have Arabic twist in them, so we kind of target the Arab-speaking, then move on to the rest of the audience.
Do you think Middle Eastern gamers look for something different to European and American gamers?
Not pretty much, no. I think that there are a lot of similarities between a Middle Eastern gamer and a Western gamer, because the medium is the same, the entertainment is the same, and the behavior is the same. Everybody here has a smartphone. Everybody is passionate about playing on mobile. Maybe I might add that an Arabic user living in the Middle East can be a little bit more interested in gaming than others because of the smartphone penetration that we have. For example, in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the smartphone penetration can be as high as 200%. Hence, the user has the medium in his hand more than a Western user. But to be fair, I would say that there are no particular differences between an Arabic user in terms of gaming and a Western user.
This new game of yours, Run for Peace, is kind of a humorous and satirical take on Middle Eastern conflict. How much of a sense of humour do you think Arabs have about this stuff? Were you at all worried that people might think it was in poor taste?
I was worried, yes, and my team was worried as well. But we tried as much as we can to avoid anything that has to do with a certain political party or a certain religion or a certain way of thinking. So we did something for peace in general, and then we added the sense of humor in it. So when you play the game, you will find a lot of funny noises, a lot of funny sounds, the funny music. The character himself is, looks funny with a big head and a small body and so on. So we try to merge the fun feeling with the peace without attacking or talking or hinting about anything that has to do with politics or religion. But yeah, we were afraid because in this part of the world, people tend to think about things in a more political / religious way, none of those.
Well, yeah, avoiding religion and politics and any consideration of the Middle East isn't easy. And your character, Salim, runs across the Middle East from Saudi Arabia to Algeria. Does he visit Israel?
Well, actually, we didn't include that for many reasons. I mean, the first reason is that we didn't include all the Arabic countries for strategic thinking. That is, we don't have enough memory to put all the countries in the game. So we put only about 10 countries. Whereas in the Middle East, you have more than 10 countries, Avoiding Israel, I mean, let's face it, the Middle East do not see Israel as a country. They see Palestine as opposed to Israel. So we didn't want to enter in this, and we thought that if we mentioned Palestine or Israel or any other country, we might have people that will start asking questions. So we said, you know, let's keep it away from now. Let's focus on the other Arabic countries and let's do the game accordingly.
I know your game is essentially a humorous and fun kind of game, but is there much appetite in the Middle East for video games, whether they're humorous or serious, based on Middle Eastern conflict?
I wouldn't say yes, because people here, and especially Arabs that live here, they think about video games as a runaway from their daily lives. So if they want to take a break from the politics and from all the bad things that happen around them, they watch humor TV or they play games. So to answer your question, no. An Arabic user would not look at this as an escape from him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what we did, we included a lot the humor part and focused a bit on the peace to have a game that is really fun but with a nice bottom line, with a nice goal behind it.
And you're donating 5% of the profits to UNESCO. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, a lot of the NGOs in the region are active, and a lot need donations and need money for the refugees, for hungry people, for poor people, you know, all different NGOs. So we thought that because it has a noble goal, we wanted to give something in return to those people. And actually, we are saying we're giving 5% from the iPhone version and 10% from the iPad version to our to UNESCO, because we really wanted to share what we are doing with the unfortunate, let's say, which the best way would be UNESCO, because it's, you know, an international NGO that will help everybody.
And what other kind of projects are you working on? Have you already started considering a sequel to Run for Peace?
Yes, we are already working on that, actually. Let me put it like this. Our main goal is to run for peace worldwide. So we started with the Middle East. We're going to target other regions in the future. We're working already on other countries with new behavior, new gameplay, new strategies. And the sequel will be coming a couple of months after now, so end of the summer maybe. And then again, each 2 months, we'll add more countries and more regions of the world. Our ultimate goal is to achieve peace worldwide. Our ultimate goal is that the game would help achieving peace worldwide.
That was Lebanon Nader of the Beirut-based game designer Game Cooks, and that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Daniel Giacopelli, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Alex Jakes. Coming up next is the news, and then this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs. In 3 hours' time at 2200, Ted Kravitz and Dom Reynolds will be here for the Monocle Daily. I've been Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Good evening.